Welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices, move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. The death notices from today's Arizona Republic: Wallace D. Cornelius, age 97, from Sun Lakes. Dina Bachelor Evan, age 82, from Phoenix. Michael Sean Fenlon, age 57, from Scottsdale. J. Morton Rhodes, age 85, from Phoenix. And Michael Edward Ricola, age 73, from Phoenix. And turning to the business section, the top of the page: FTC bans hidden junk fees in hotel and ticket prices. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission passed a rule on Tuesday requiring ticket sellers, hotels, and vacation rental sites to disclose total prices, including fees up front, prohibiting them from concealing add-on charges until the last minute. The rule is one of the final pieces of President Joe Biden's wide-ranging crackdown on junk fees that drive up consumer costs without providing visible benefits. We all know the experience of encountering a hidden fee at the very last stage of checkout. These junk fees sneak into your bill, and companies end up making you pay more because they can. Those fees add up, taking real money out of the pockets of Americans, Biden said in a statement. The FTC passed the rule 4-1, with the lone dissenting vote coming from Andrew Ferguson, a Republican who is poised to take over the agency's chair when President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Ferguson voted against the rule because he said the time for rulemaking by the Biden-Harris FTC is over. He did not express an opinion on whether the FTC should enforce the rule once Trump takes office. Trump could seek to withdraw the rule for further review, and Republicans who will have control of Congress could seek to vacate it by law. Republican Commissioner Melissa Holyoke voted for the rule, saying it helps protect consumers and competition while also preserving flexibility for businesses to engage in lawful advertising and pricing practices. The rule would require service fees, resort fees, and other charges commonly added to bookings to be included in advertised prices. The rule is narrower than what the FTC proposed in 2023 that would have broadly banned hidden and deceptive fees, regardless of industry. I urge enforcers to continue cracking down on these unlawful fees and encourage state and federal policymakers to build on this success with legislation that bans unfair and deceptive junk fees across the economy, FTC Chair Lina Khan said in a statement. The FTC estimates the rule would save U.S. consumers 53 million hours per year. They would not have to spend sleuthing out total costs before making purchases. Biden's regulators have taken aim at inflated and hidden fees. Though their efforts have been met with lawsuits by businesses and corporate interest groups. A judge in Texas blocked a rule that would cap credit card late fees, and an appeals court in New Orleans blocked a requirement that airlines disclose baggage and other fees up front. These cases are ongoing. And Walmart's Mexican unit faces more fines. Mexico's antitrust watchdog, COFECE, said on Monday that it would fine Walmart's local unit, Walmex, up to 8% of its income if it does not comply with a resolution prohibiting the retailer from engaging in certain conduct deemed illegal. COFECE's statement offered more details on a ruling that Walmex reported Friday, in which the regulator ordered the company to pay a fine of more than $4.62 million for engaging in a monopolistic practice involving its suppliers. For 13 years, Walmart used its market power to impose abusive conditions on its suppliers, obtaining illegal advantages over its competitors, the watchdog said in a statement, outlining several prohibitions it levied on Mexico's top retailer. According to the statement, Walmart de Mexico, known as Walmex, had a system that allowed it to impose discretionary discounts, pressuring its suppliers not to offer better prices and terms to other retailers, which severely harmed them, especially small and medium-sized businesses. Walmex did not immediately respond for a request for comment on COFECE's statement, but said last week it believes the regulator's analysis is incorrect and that it will appeal its ruling. COFECE on Monday said it had prohibited Walmex from taking reprisals against suppliers in the form of sanctions or terminated contracts in retaliation for the supplier's commercial relations with other self-serve stores. The antitrust body said it also prohibited Walmex from demanding or imposing prices on its suppliers and from requiring its suppliers to provide information on the prices or conditions they offer to other businesses. COFECE will verify compliance with the measures for 10 years and may fine Walmart up to 8% of its income if it does not comply with this resolution, the regulator said. COFECE is one of several government watchdogs that Mexico's Congress voted last month to abolish while giving its competition policing powers to other government agencies. The watchdog's resolution followed a roughly four-year investigation into Mexico's largest private employer. And retail sales showcase a strong economy. U.S. retail sales increased more than expected in November as households stepped up on purchases of motor vehicles and online merchandise, consistent with strong underlying momentum in the economy as the year winds down. The report from the Commerce Department on Tuesday had no impact on expectations that the Federal Reserve would cut interest rates on Wednesday for the third time since the U.S. Central Bank initiated its policy easing cycle in September. Fed officials started a two-day policy meeting on Tuesday. Signs of strong domestic demand added to warmer inflation readings in recent months in suggesting that the Fed could pause rate cuts in January. Policies planned by President-elect Donald Trump's incoming administration, including tariffs on imports and mass deportations of undocumented immigrants, are also seen complicating matters for the central bank. The market is still discounting a 25 basis points rate cut tomorrow. But if consumers are still buying interest-sensitive goods like autos, a national markets observer would have to wonder why would a central bank add fuel to the fire with a president-elect coming in at the end of January with one of the most pro-growth agendas of any president in history, Christopher Rupke, chief economist at Forward Bonds, said on Tuesday. Retail sales jumped 0.7% last month after an upwardly revised 0.5% gain in October, the Commerce Department Census Bureau said. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast retail sales, which are mostly for goods and are not adjusted for inflation, advancing 0.5%. Estimates ranged from 0.1% dip to a 1.0% surge. Retail sales increased 3.8% year over year in November. Labor market resilience, characterized by historically low layoffs and strong wage growth, is underpinning consumer spending. Strong household balance sheets, reflecting record stock market prices and high home prices, are also driving spending. Household savings remain supportive. Economists expect policymakers will signal fewer rate cuts in 2025 when they update their summary of economic projections on Wednesday. Unless the labor market materially weakens, investors should expect the Fed to ease rates next year, but not as much as originally hoped, said Jeffrey Roach, chief economist at LPL Financial. The solid increase in retail sales came despite a late Thanksgiving holiday that pushed Cyber Monday into December and was consistent with a strong start to the holiday shopping season. Sales at auto dealerships jumped 2.6%, likely boosted by residents replacing motor vehicles damaged by hurricanes Helene and Milton. Online retail sales vaulted 1.8%, probably reflecting early holiday promotions. Receipts at sporting goods, hobby, musical instrument, and bookstores increased 0.9%. Building material and garden equipment store sales rose 4.4%, likely as residents rebuilt in areas devastated by Helene and Milton. There were also decent gains in sales at electronics, appliance stores, as well as furniture outlets, but there were pockets of weakness and hints of belt tightening among some consumers, especially low-income households. Though layoffs remain low, hiring has cooled down. Consumer debt loads are expanding. Receipts at food services and drinking places, the only services component in the report, fell 0.4% after increasing 0.9% in October. Economists view dining out as a key indicator of household finances. Sales at clothing stores decreased 0.2%. Grocery store sales also declined 0.2%. Sales at miscellaneous retailers, which include florists and gift shops, dropped 3.5%, extending the prior month's decline. Nonetheless, consumers generally remain in good shape. Retail sales, excluding automobiles, gasoline, building materials, and food services, rose 0.4% last month after a 0.1% dip in October. These so-called core retail sales correspond most closely with the consumer spending component of gross domestic product. They rose 0.3% after adjusting for inflation. Growth in core retail sales averaged 6.5% annualized rate in the last 3 months. Economists estimated that consumer spending was running at around 3.3% pace so far in the fourth quarter. Consumer spending grew at 3.5% rate in the third quarter, accounting for most of the economy's 2.8% pace of expansion during that period. The Atlanta Fed is forecasting the GDP increasing at a 3.1% pace in the fourth quarter. We expect households to keep spending into the new year, but for the pace of consumption to slow as the year progresses and tariff-related price pressure bites, said Shannon Grine, an economist at Wells Fargo. While the broad household sector is still in a decent financial position today, data suggests consumers are growing more vulnerable amid slowing real income growth and still high financing costs. While consumers continue to carry the economy on their shoulders, manufacturing remains downbeat, in part because of the lingering effects of the Fed's policy tightening and crippling strike by factory workers at Boeing. Factory output increased 0.2% in November after a downwardly revised 0.7% decline in October, the Fed said. Economists had forecast production rebounding 0.5% after a previously reported 0.5% decrease. Though the Boeing strike ended in early November, production of aerospace and miscellaneous transportation equipment fell 2.6%. That was attributed to declines in the manufacturing of aircraft parts and followed a 6.7 tumble in October. It partially offset a 3.5% jump in motor vehicle and parts output. Tariffs loom over the sector next year. The threat of tariffs on imported raw materials and intermediate goods likely will stimulate manufacturing output briefly as firms seek to increase inventory and control costs, said Samuel Tomes, chief U.S. economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics. Nonetheless, we think that heightened uncertainty over tariff and immigration policy will dissuade manufacturers from investing in additional capacity until the policy picture is clearer, he said. And we'll turn to the sports section now, and we'll start with Bob McManaman's column. Time to use your weapons. Card's dynamic Dortch must be involved more. Trey McBride has the sixth most receptions, 89, of any pass catcher in the NFL, and ranks 11th in the receiving yards, 938. On the flip side, the Cardinals' tight end has also set a league record for most catches in a season without a touchdown reception. Cardinals' first round pick, Marvin Harrison Jr., meanwhile, entered Week 15 with the most touchdown catches, 7, among all rookie wide receivers, until the Jaguars' Brian Thomas Jr. had more on Sunday to take the lead with 8. Harrison has looked great at times and almost invisible at others. Michael Wilson, Arizona's number 2 wideout, was hoping for a breakout season in year 2. He's been decent, but he's caught more than 5 passes just once and had 60 or more receiving yards only twice. Then there's the curious case of Greg Dortch, who was supposed to double as the Cardinals' designated punt returner and starting slot receiver. He's averaging 9.4 yards on 16 punt returns, but he started only 2 games as the Cardinals' number 3 man, including Sunday's 30-17 win over the Patriots, and he's caught more than 4 passes only once when he had 6 receptions in the season opener at Buffalo. When they're able to get the ball, though, good things happen. Since going undrafted out of Wake Forest in 2019, bouncing among 4 teams before landing with the Cardinals, he's been relatively involved in Arizona's offense for the past 3 seasons. He's been targeted 7 or more times in just 9 of his past 46 games, but he's had 60 receptions in those contests, an average of 6.7 catches. Dortch was targeted only 3 times against the Patriots, but he caught all 3 passes for 60 yards, including one that he turned into a 39-yard gain. "I thought he was lights out today," Coach Jonathan Gannon said after the game, which snapped the Cardinals' 3-game skid. "The one huge play in the 2 minutes that gave us points on the 3rd and long, there was another 3rd down he converted. He's a playmaker, man. When he gets the ball in his hands, he can make plays for us. He does a lot, too. He wears a lot of hats for us on game day, as you saw. Offensively, he lets his pads do the talking. I know that." Dortch doesn't usually say much, which probably partly explains why he showered, dressed, and left the locker room before Gannon even finished his post-game news conference. Others don't mind speaking on behalf of the 6-year pro from Richmond, Virginia. "It's hard to put a price tag on G," quarterback Kyler Murray said following Sunday's win. "The nuance that he brings, the feel that he has for the game. I don't think anybody can make anybody miss in a phone booth like he can. You just give him the ball. He calls himself the chain mover for a reason. When the ball gets in G's hands, good stuff usually happens." Even when there's a mistake made, like there was on Sunday when Dortch fumbled on a running play near the goal line in the first quarter, it turns out just fine. Dortch took an inside handoff from Murray and scrambled around left end. He was brought down as he neared pay dirt, and the ball squirted loose and rolled into the end zone. Right tackle Jonah Williams, however, was right there to pounce on the fumble for a touchdown, which gave the Cardinals an early 10-0 lead. "I was pulling around and trying to block for Dortch, and it was just sort of a see ball, get ball," Williams said. "I saw it on the ground, sprinted, and fell on it. It was definitely slow motion. I felt like I was running about 6 miles an hour, but I think I was going faster, just trying to fall forward and try to get on the ball. It was a lot of fun." It's difficult to say if it's been all that fun for Greg Dortch. He entered the season expecting to finally be a regular contributor on offense, but like each of the previous 2 years, he's had to keep waiting his turn for the opportunities to come. They've been few and far between, like always. According to Gannon, however, it doesn't seem to have dampened Dortch's spirits. He said that in response to a post-game question about what he sees from the 5'7", 175-pound playmaker every day in practice, before he answered, a wide smile appeared on Gannon's face. "I like to describe him as he lets his pads do the talking," Gannon said. He, for being a little bit of a smaller guy, plays really big. He really does. He practices and he loves to play. He's done a really good job since we've been here to maximize his opportunity, and his role has expanded. I've got all the faith in him, and he does things the right way. He's a true pro. He's one of that leadership committee that I lean on. He always brings energy, and I'm glad we have him." They should be glad. Now, if they could only find a way to get him the football more often. When they do, good things usually happen. And continuing with the Cardinals, "Why is Murray not running more?" It's written by Theo Mackey for the Arizona Republic. When the Cardinals needed 2 yards last week against the Seahawks, coordinator Drew Petzing went to his offense's greatest weapon. He dialed up a designated run for Kyler Murray, with James Conner serving as both a decoy and a lead blocker. It worked to perfection. Murray strolled into the end zone untouched for the two-point conversion. It was also Murray's only designed run over the past 2 games. And because it came on a 2-point conversion, it doesn't officially count toward his stats. Since week 8, he has just 27 rush attempts for 130 yards, his fewest rush attempts and second fewest yards over a 7-game span in his career. Since the bye, Murray's lack of running has only been amplified. In those 4 games, he's seen 3 designed rush attempts per FTN data. The list of quarterbacks with more includes all of the league's best dual threat quarterbacks, but also Jameis Winston, Will Levis, Matthew Stafford, Brock Purdy, Aiden O'Connell, and Jared Goff. None of those players possess nearly the threat that Murray does with his legs. Just look at the damage Murray has created when he does run. He's averaging a career-low 4.5 attempts per game, but a career-high 7.2 yards per attempt. On designed runs, he's even better, averaging 8.3 yards per attempt, the most of any starting quarterback. The issue? 8 quarterbacks have more designed rushing attempts, mitigating the overall impact of Murray's legs. Back in training camp, Petzing said that Murray's ability on designed runs, especially under center, had stood out during his first season working with the Cardinals franchise quarterback. It seemed at the time as if he were suggesting that it could be a larger part of his offense in year 2. So why hasn't that manifested itself? I think it's a number of different things, Petzing said. A lot of those are read runs or off-schedule plays. So sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't, based on the way that people are rushing him, based on the way the coverage is dictated. If guys are open or there's places to go with the ball, he's not going to need to extend the play. The Cardinals' offense also includes a heavy dose of read options in which the defense dictates where the ball goes. Obviously, he's a big threat, so I think a lot of people are giving him looks where he's getting the ball handed off, Petzing said. And that's one reason why you see James having the success that he's having in the run game. That paid off Sunday. On Connor's 53-yard run in the first half, the New England Patriots had an edge defender solely focused on Murray's rushing threat. That meant the Cardinals had to block one fewer player, enabling them to outnumber the Patriots on the front side of the play so that Connor could break off an explosive play. The threat is always there, Petzing said. I think it certainly has a tremendous impact on our run game as a whole. The reality is that at any point he could pull that thing and take it around the edge and create the big play, as he has numerous times this year. And the moment defenses back off, Murray makes them pay. His lack of running was last a key talking point back in week 5 after a loss to the Commanders. In the next game, he took a read option 50 yards to the house on the Cardinals' first drive. But in recent months, defenses haven't made that possible. It's not just off read options either. This past week, Murray seemed to have a chance at a scramble for a big gain, only for a defender to play it perfectly and bring Murray down at the line of scrimmage as he attempted a spin move. Last month, he was unable to convert a fourth down keeper against the Seahawks because Seattle cornerback Devin Witherspoon read the play instantly and displayed incredible athleticism to cover the flat. Plus, Murray is at his best as a scrambler when he can take off up the middle. Cardinals tackles have often been more effective than their interior offensive linemen, preventing those holes from opening for him. Still, the overall rushing numbers remain jarringly low for a player with Murray's rushing threat. Over his first 4 seasons, he averaged 6.7 rushing attempts per game. Since his torn ACL, and since Petzing became the offensive coordinator, he's averaging 4.9 rushing attempts per game. Petzing believes that Murray is absolutely back to his pre-injury athleticism, but the numbers are even more extreme on designed runs. From 2020 to 2022, he averaged 3.2 designed runs per game. Over the past two seasons, he's averaging 1.9. Do those numbers concern Petsing? I'm happy as long as we're winning, Petsing said, and I know that's an easy answer, but I think it's real. I never go into a game saying he's got to carry it this many times, or I never want him over this number. And continuing with the Cardinals, Cards extend All-Pro Baker in three-year deal. The heart and soul of the Arizona Cardinals defense is staying in town. On Tuesday evening, the Cardinals agreed to a three-year, $54 million contract extension with safety Buda Baker, who was set to become a free agent after this season. The extension includes $30 million in guaranteed money. The Cardinals have now avoided free agency with their two highest-profile free agents-to-be. Last month, they agreed to a two-year deal with running back James Conner, a crucial leader of their offense. Now they've done the same with a leader of their defense. He's a competitor, Cardinals coach Jonathan Gannon said recently, the ultimate competitor. Since being drafted by Arizona in the second round in 2017, Baker has been named a first-team All-Pro twice, a second-team All-Pro once, and a Pro Bowler six times. Last year, he missed five games with a hamstring injury and did not make his typical impact, but was still named to the Pro Bowl. This season, that should be a certainty, as the bare minimum. Baker ranks second in the NFL with 142 tackles and has been just as good by more advanced metrics. He has a 76.7 grade this season from the analytics site Pro Football Focus, the best mark of his career, and the top 10 among starting safeties. He's been excellent in coverage and recorded two sacks and 10 pressures as a pass rusher. His best work, though, has come in the run game, with a career-high 9 tackles for loss. By average annual value, Baker's contract makes him the NFL's fourth highest paid safety, behind Antoine Winfield, Derwin James, and Minka Fitzpatrick. By total value, it ranks 7th at the position. The deal keeps him in Arizona through his age 31 season in 2027. The Cardinals' highest profile impeding free agents now include linebacker Kazir White, kicker Matt Prater, and left guard Evan Brown. The team must also figure out whether to re-sign guard Will Hernandez and edge rusher Dennis Gardeck, both out with season-ending knee injuries, but expected to be ready for the 2025 season. Beyond that group, a handful of members of the defensive line rotation, namely L.J. Collier, Roy Lopez, Naquan Jones, and Jesse Luketa, are set to hit free agency. None of the Cardinals' remaining free agents, though, carry Baker's impact. He is the player opposing offenses' schemes around. He is the player whose voice commands the attention of the locker room. And now he's 3 years closer to being a Cardinal for life. And a road game at the Rams is set for primetime broadcast. The Arizona Cardinals will be in the Week 17 spotlight. The Cardinals' road game against the division-leading Los Angeles Rams has been scheduled for 6:15 p.m., Saturday, December 28th, in a matchup at SoFi Stadium in L.A. The game will be televised nationally on NFL Network and locally on NBC. The Saturday slate will kick off with the Los Angeles Chargers at the New England Patriots, followed by the Denver Broncos at the Cincinnati Bengals, with the Cardinals-Rams matchup capping the triple header. Like the Cardinals-Rams game, the other two games will be broadcast on the NFL Network. The Saturday schedule? Chargers at Patriots, 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. Broncos at Bengals, 2:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. And Cardinals at Rams at 6:15 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. For the Cardinals, the Saturday night game could have significant playoff implications. They are one game behind the Rams in the NFC West standings. Depending on results this week, a win could put them ahead of Los Angeles or draw them even. Plus, a win would give the Cardinals the tiebreaker, having already crushed the Rams 41-10 back in Week 2. Two other games under consideration were the Colts at Giants and Falcons at Commanders, both of which are moved to Sunday, December 29th. The Falcons-Commanders game flexes into the Sunday night football slot, replacing Dolphins-Browns. And the Colts-Giants game will be played Sunday afternoon in New York. And we'll take a look at some sports briefs before we leave this section. Jones, Cowboys plan to keep star edge Parsons. Dallas Cowboys all-pro edge rusher Micah Parsons is not being traded, a sentiment shared directly by franchise owner Jerry Jones. Making his weekly appearance on 105.3 The Fan, Jones was adamant Parsons remains part of the Cowboys foundation into the future. Jones said any idea of trading the two-time first-team All-Pro has never been uttered in this organization. And the Giants and Raiders lead race for number one in the 2025 draft. An averted comeback sent the Las Vegas Raiders to their 12th loss of the season on Monday, even with the New York Giants for the worst record in the NFL this season. The Giants, 2-12, are up on the Raiders, 2-12, by mere percentage points, with 3 weeks remaining in the race for the number one pick in the 2025 NFL draft. Schedule strength indicates more than a two-horse field for the premium placement in the 2025 draft. The New England Patriots, 3-11, are number one in the NFL with two dates against the Buffalo Bills, 11-3, and a Week 17 visit from the Los Angeles Chargers, 8-6. The Chicago Bears appear to be out of the running for a repeat of the number one pick, but dropped to 4-10 in a blowout 32-12 loss to the Minnesota Vikings on Monday. The setback put the Bears in the top 10 of the current draft order, in the shadow of the New York Jets, who are 4-10. But the Patriots, Carolina Panthers, Jacksonville Jaguars, Tennessee Titans, and Cleveland Browns all reside a rung higher in the order with 3 wins with 3 to play. And New Orleans Saints quarterback Derek Carr is considered very unlikely to return this season because of multiple fractures in his left hand, NFL Network reported on Tuesday. The report comes one day after New Orleans interim coach Darren Rizzi said Carr wouldn't be ruled out for Week 16, which is a trip to play the Green Bay Packers on Monday night. Carr is also not cleared from concussion protocol and didn't play Sunday in a 20-19 loss to the Washington Commanders, in which Spencer Rattler relieved Jake Haener and led 4 scoring drives in a near come-from-behind win. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. And time now for the opinions and editorials section of today's Arizona Republic. The first is written by guest columnist Tom Zellner. Dems lost touch before losing the election. As the Democratic Party tries to figure out why it took such a bruising last month, let me tell you what went wrong after working on various campaigns, including this one, as a grunt volunteer for nearly 20 years. The story of Democratic failure in Arizona, put simply, is a myopic focus on flipping the Phoenix suburbs while taking a blue Tucson for granted and completely ignoring everyone else. The advice they're getting from Washington, D.C. consultants does not take into account the independent-minded voters in rural Arizona who can be persuaded to flip if they trust that their problems are being heard. With an obsessive focus on educated voters in the cities, Arizona Democrats have forgotten how to speak rural. This might seem a trivial concern, considering that roughly 20% of the electorate lives beyond the last streetlights of Phoenix and Tucson. But the state's deepest image of itself has always resided in the libertarian attitudes of wide open spaces. Appealing to the pragmatic cowboy archetype usually has a psychological spillover effect to the cities. Many Arizonans think of themselves as rugged individualists, even if they live on a golf course and pay dues to an HOA. I went out last month to knock on doors for Kamala Harris in La Paz County, one of several in Arizona without a functioning Democratic Party. Not even one contact person was listed on the website. The rural outreach coordinator had resigned and was not replaced. I was one of just 5 people in that county trying to turn out voters on Election Day weekend in what we had been told was a crucial swing state. Yes, 5 people. They did not fill out the paperwork in time to have any Democratic observers inside the polls or to perform the mandatory hand count as required by law. A similar lapse occurred in Apache County, where not enough party representatives showed up to do a hand count. Technical glitches with ballot printing also left voters, most of them from the Navajo Nation, standing in line for hours. Harris supporters outside Pima or Maricopa counties found it difficult or impossible to get campaign literature or yard signage. This was a complete abandonment of the rural counties, Jamie Morgain said, who ran an unsuccessful race for legislative district along the Colorado River. It was a betrayal of our own tenets. I asked Patricia Sakaris, the communications director for the state party, about this. The Arizona Democratic Party distributed $300,000 in grants that county chairs could use to mobilize voters and build stronger party infrastructure, especially in rural areas, she wrote in an email. The party also opened 19 offices across the state, which knocked on 557,809 rural voters' doors and engaged 18,821 volunteers from non-Pima and Maricopa counties, and hosted halls in each one of the counties. Trump won Arizona by roughly 6 percentage points and was certainly helped by dampening support from suburban Phoenix, which Joe Biden enjoyed in his 2020 win. But Trump's blowout in 13 rural counties, he took about 60% of the vote there, was a major contributing factor to flipping Arizona back into the red column and possibly even out of the category of swing state. To be fair to the Arizona Democratic Party, the tactical myopia of shafting the countryside is an attitude that comes from the top. Democrats began moving funding away from their county offices years ago, mirroring a belief that the future lay in winning the educated suburban vote. Bill Clinton won more than 1,000 rural counties in 1996. Obama won 455 of them. Biden won less than 200. Kamala Harris did even worse. But the Democratic National Committee consistently denies there is a rural problem and has done little to stop the hemorrhage, even though they lost control of the Senate because they lost seats they used to hold in rural-heavy electorates like North Dakota, Iowa, and Louisiana in the last 8 years. For all the money that Democrats save by not funding county offices and making rural people feel understood, what do we get in return? An astonishing amount of donor money thrown away on TV ads in urban markets, mainly for the benefit of notching up consultants' fees. Look through the financial statements of Arizona Democrats. Shows a pattern of spending to various Washington spin and ad shops, Copper Sky, The Pivot Group, Accelerate, Symmetry Media. Because of the emphasis on fleeting digital connections over year-long face-to-face contact, volunteers are guided toward temporary phone banking, that is, calling up registered Democrats and reading a prepared script, in an exercise that is becoming increasingly useless. Even the hardcore loyalists are getting sick of the constant alarmism, texting, and pleas for more money. There's only so much of this people can take before they tune out. But trying to deliver this message to Washington consultants is a futile exercise. Too much money is at stake, and it is harder for outsiders to monetize the years-long effort it takes to build a county organization than it is to take a percentage nick from yet another redundant television ad. That $1.5 billion raised by Harris' campaign had to go somewhere, after all. If we don't see this disdainful attitude toward ordinary rural Arizonans as a major problem, we deserve our own exile from Washington. Patty Cervantes, the chair of the Graham County Democratic Party in rural eastern Arizona, summed it up quite well. "Democrats are just so locked into statistics and Zoom meetings that we've lost touch with the people," she said. That was written by Tom Zellner, a former Arizona Republic reporter. He's the author of the book Rim to River, Looking into the Heart of Arizona. You can reach him on Blue Sky at Tom, Tom-Zellner, that's Zoellner, dot BSKY dot social. And the next editorial is by Phil Boas, Arizona Republic columnist. My bet, feds know all about those mysterious drones. As we try to comprehend the frenzy over drones on the East Coast, understand this. These are friendly aircraft because there is no way, No way, all caps. The United States government could play this coy, pretending Americans are hallucinating if these flying objects in fact posed a threat. We believe there are cases of mistaken identity, where drones are actually small aircraft and people are misidentifying them, Homeland Security Director Alejandro Mayorkas told CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Secretary Mayorkas, with all due respect, that's malarkey. He went on to say, there may very well be drones in the sky. Of course those are commercially available. One can go into a convenience store and buy a small drone there. There are also commercial drones as well. Even more malarkey. These are not hobby drones, and if they were commercial drones flying en masse in coordinated flight, our government would know who, when, and where, and why. News Nation investigative correspondent Rich McHugh shared the government's expressed skepticism as he approached the story late last week. When, quote, it first came out a few weeks ago, as a resident of New Jersey, as a journalist, I didn't pay it much credence, he told his audience. I thought it would turn out to be a bunch of pranksters and this would be all over by now. The experience I had last night, however, changed the way I feel about this story completely. What I saw was more sophisticated than I ever imagined. McHugh went on to tell how he accompanied Ocean County Sheriff's Department in central New Jersey late last week as they launched their own drone to try to intercept the mystery crafts their officers were seeing. Sheriff's officers told him the mystery drones evade detection because they don't emit heat like regular drones. They could not explain why. It's not something they've ever encountered before. One of their officers called 911 after seeing 50 drones come across the Atlantic Ocean and across the Jersey shoreline. They contacted New Jersey State Police, the FBI, and the U.S. Coast Guard, at which point the Coast Guard went out and reported seeing 13 drones from their boat, Ocean County Sheriff Michael Mastronardi said. Finally, McHugh showed a video that depicts strange flashing lights above the Jersey coastline. What I can tell you is that I've never seen anything like it before. In response to these types of sightings, Secretary Mayorkas told Blitzer, we haven't seen anything unusual. We know of no threat. The latter part I believe, because our federal government knows there is no threat. Try to imagine the sheer incompetence required for the U.S. Defense Department and Homeland Security to remain mystified weeks after hundreds of Americans have witnessed what appear to be singular and coordinated masses of mysterious aircraft flying in off the Atlantic Ocean. Either these sightings by civilians, law enforcement, and the U.S. Coast Guard are a mirage, or our government is holding back. Adding intrigue to the matter was President-elect Donald Trump, who told the media, the government knows what is happening. Our military knows where they took off from. It's a garage. They can go right into that garage, where it came from and where it went. And for some reason, they don't want to comment. And I think that would be better. They would be better off saying what it is. Our military knows, and our president knows. And for some reason, they want to keep people in suspense. Given Trump's looseness with facts about bleach and COVID-19 and migrants and small animals, this is less than authoritative. If the drone craze was not already crazy enough, we got this last Saturday. Defense contractor Palantir Technologies aired a darkly themed and lit commercial on drone warfare that seems evocative of U.S. defense plans to thwart a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan. The only word message in the ad appears at the end. Battles are won before they begin. That would seem to match the messaging earlier this year from the Pentagon. This past summer, Samuel Paparo, the new head of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, told the Washington Post's national security writer Josh Rogan that the U.S. military planned to thwart a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan with a plan called Hellscape. The idea is that as soon as China's invasion fleet begins moving across the 100-mile waterway that separates China and Taiwan, explained Rogan, the U.S. military would deploy thousands of unmanned submarines, unmanned surface ships, and aerial drones to flood the area and give Taiwanese, U.S., and partner forces times to mount a full response. It's no secret that U.S. defense officials are concerned about a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, particularly after reports that China's President Xi Jinping had ordered his military to prepare to invade Taiwan by 2027. Nor is it a secret that we're in a delicate political moment that could prove tempting to the Chinese. We have a country that is politically polarized and a president who is mentally infirm as we await the transition of power to the new Trump administration. What the hell is going on? Are the Defense Department and its military-industrial partners firing a shot across the Chinese bow? Does Washington have information that a Chinese invasion of Taiwan is imminent? For his part, Rogan said on a podcast that aired on Monday on The Dispatch that we will misframe the issue if we ask the question, will the Chinese invade Taiwan? China is already invading Taiwan in every way except for militarily, he said. They're using economic coercion, information warfare, cyber warfare, political interference, and literally blockading the country on a random basis, threatening them, shooting missiles over them, attacking their diplomatic stature, keeping them out of international organizations they need to be in, and overall just trying to make their lives miserable on a daily basis. And that is a strategy that Beijing is using to strangle the country, like a boa constrictor, meanwhile bribing and coercing any politician they can. It would behoove the Pentagon to come clean on what's going on with drones in the sky over New Jersey. Otherwise, they'll leave it to Madge and Passaic to fumble with her kid's telescope and inform an eager nation. And that was written by Phil Boas, editorial columnist with the Arizona Republic. You can email him at phil.boas@arizonarepublic.com. And time now for the horoscopes for today, Wednesday, December 18th, 2024. If you're in Aries, you may not know which direction to go when the sun squares off with Neptune. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, a challenge of faith may overcome you. For Gemini, May 21st to June 21st, the holes may show in your professional boundaries. Have you been too open in your contracts with others? For Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd, you want more freedom in your work but may not know how to achieve it. Are you discouraged with the daily grind? For Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd, confused by someone else's wants, your desires may not link up while the sun squares off with Neptune. For Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, someone may step over your invisible line at home today. Too close for comfort? The sun and Neptune blur boundaries. For Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd, you may overestimate what you can get done. The sun activates Neptune today, pushing you to shoot for unrealistic goals. For Scorpio, October 21st to November 21st, doubting the value of your creativity? Watch for disillusion. For Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st, you may feel overwhelmed by a home or family issue. The sun confronting Neptune compels you to disengage entirely. For Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, examine the holes in your thinking. A story you've denied may get the spotlight while the sun confronts Neptune. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, question the value of putting a friend on the spot. Will it help or hurt to speak your truth? And finally, for Pisces, February 19th to March 20th, a goal you once held may be turning to dust. Not feeling the inspiration you used to? Let it go. And time now for Dear Abby. First letter. Dear Abby, I was with my ex-fiancé for 13 years. Not long after he broke up with me, I found myself going to meet him at a hotel. We've been seeing each other regularly, once a week at least. We go out and enjoy our time together like we are dating. The frustrating thing is, he doesn't want to let me know where he lives. He says it's a comfort thing for him to have just his space. It's been a year and a half since our breakup. Anytime I ask about our situation, he says he doesn't know what he wants. All the things he does for me show he loves me and cares about me. It feels like we are in this weird limbo, almost like he's stringing me along because he doesn't say if he ever wants to get back together. He says, "Why can't you just enjoy what we're doing? I want more with him and better than we had before. We were in a bad place before, and I didn't treat him well. I was going through things and I took it out on him. In our time apart, no longer being a couple, I've worked on myself to become a happier and healthier person and have gotten my life in order. I love him very much, and I'm hoping for more. Any advice? Signed, Situationship in California. Dear Situationship, when a person is secretive, they usually have something to hide. Because your not quite ex refuses to give you his address after a year and a half, it's likely he has someone living there with him. Before your engagement ended, you demonstrated that you could be abusive when you were stressed. That he doesn't want to risk another round of that is understandable. From what you've written, he's enjoying things just the way they are. He doesn't want more. Because you do, you'll have to find someone who can give you the future you're looking for. And the next letter. Dear Abby, I'm a straight male who likes wearing ladies' biker shorts under my shorts and pants. In the winter, I love wearing ladies' leggings and stockings because they keep my feet warm. They keep my legs warm. I also love the way they feel. No one knows about me doing this. I've been in a relationship for many years, and my girlfriend doesn't know. Is it okay to wear these items? Signed, Secretive in New York. Dear Secretive, from your description, you are what is defined as an undercover crossdresser. By doing this, you are hurting no one. You are far from the only man who enjoys it. Yes, it's okay to continue as you've been doing. And the last letter here. Dear Abby, I have a brother-in-law who, when he gives a hello or goodbye hug, wants to give a kiss on the lips. My wife doesn't want the kiss and turns her head away. He then proceeds to kiss her on the cheek, which he doesn't want either, especially when it's an open mouth slobber. He does this with other sisters-in-law, and most of them turn their heads when he comes running with the pucker. How can we approach this situation without hurting his feelings or embarrassing him? Signed, Smooched in Wisconsin. Dear Smooched, may I be frank? People who are so insensitive that they fail to recognize when a kiss is unwanted need to be told that it is a turnoff. If that embarrasses the kisser, so be it. Yuck. And if you'd like to write to Dear Abby, you can reach her at www.dearabby.com. And time now for the comics. We'll start with Blondie. Blondie and Dagwood are walking along a city street, passing a window that has a really fancy dress in the window, and a big sign that says sale. And Blondie says, "Look, honey, you could buy me this dress for Christmas while it's on sale." And he says, "But then you'd know what I got you for Christmas. Where's the fun in that?" And she says, "The fun would be that I could actually wear it, and it would actually be the right size." In Beetle Bailey, Beetle and his girlfriend, Miss Buxley, are walking along. They're outside. There's a moon up above and some clouds. And she says, "Should we go to a movie, have dinner at the club, or go for a walk in the park?" And Beetle's thinking, puts his hand to his mouth and kind of thinking and says, And she looks over at him, you know, just with her eyes. She doesn't turn her head and says, make your choice carefully, but be sure you choose a movie. In Baby Blues, the kids, Hammy and Zoe, come up to Mom. She's in the kitchen starting dinner, cooking. And Zoe says, "There's nothing to do." And Mom turns around and says, "What? Your holiday break hasn't even started yet. And you're already bored?" And Zoe says, or Hammy says, "Maybe we're pre-bored." And Zoe says, "That would explain it." And Wanda just looks upward at the sky as she's stirring dinner and says, "I am so looking forward to the next few weeks." In Pickles, Earl walks into the living room where his wife and his grandson are sitting on a big chair. And he says, "I broke my dang glasses bumping into the door." And his wife says, "Oh, that's too bad, Earl." He said, "Oh, no big deal." And he puts some duct tape between the actual lenses and says, "That's what duct tape was made for." And his little grandson, Nelson, turns to his grandmother and says, "Is Grandpa going to be a nerd now?" In The Born Loser, Brutus is sitting on one of those little stools you sit on in a doctor's office in the examining room. The doctor's sitting across from him. And the doctor says, "Have you had any health issues since your last exam, Brutus?" And he says, "My memory seems to get worse every year. Should I be concerned, Doc?" He says, "Nah, just forget about it." And before we end, we'll take a look at today in history. On this date, December 18th, which is the 353rd day of this year, there are 13 days left this year, 2024. But on this day in 1777, General George Washington, commander of the Continental Army and the Continental Congress, each had proclaimed this day, a Thursday, to be what was America's first national Thanksgiving celebration. And in 1903, on this date, the U.S. began controlling a 10-mile stretch of land that later became part of the Panama Canal. The U.S. solely controlled the roughly 50-mile-long canal until 1979, when a joint U.S.-Panama agency took over until passing control fully to Panama at the end of 1999. And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.